From New York, we began writing letters to San Francisco, but the replies were sketchy and uncertain. At the end of a year, an alky lady appeared at our New York office on Vesey Street. She was a little tight and crying, though of course she exaggerated a bit. She said, "Bill, we've been going a whole year in San Francisco, and do you know that at Christmas time we were all drunk?" Only a few years later, in 1951, the Lasker Award was given to Alcoholics Anonymous in the San Francisco Opera House. On the night following the award presentation, there was an AA meeting, and the huge place was packed. Sober alcoholics were practically hanging from the rafters. What once looked like a mighty poor acorn had produced a great oak. As early as 1941, the group had picked up steady wheel horses like Nick N., Ray H., and Warren T. Other starts had been made in the Bay Area, notably by Nick at Oakland and by Vic M. and Dr. P. at Sacramento. This readied the area for the impact of Jack Alexander's piece in the Saturday Evening Post. It saw Warren at work in the Kaiser Shipyard, where he became the first AA member to be employed as an alcoholic specialist by industry. And perhaps even more importantly, Warren and the others were able to start the first penitentiary group at San Quentin Prison. A footnote says Leo F. of the Los Angeles group was particularly instrumental in bringing AA to San Quentin, together with other devoted AA members of the San Francisco group. Also, Ricardo, an inmate, was continuously helpful from the beginning. By the time of the Lasker Award, the inspiring account of the founding of the first AA group behind prison walls of San Quentin was a familiar story to most of our members. San Quentin's enlightened and liberal warden, Clinton T. Duffy, had, prior to 1942, given much thought to the urgent and pressing problem of prison reform, including the special needs of the inmates imprisoned for crimes committed while drinking. As Warden Duffy said, the program he now proposed would include education, vocational training, medicine, psychiatry, and religion. But the alcoholic did not seem to fit completely into this program. All the rest would not help him if the problems which drove him to drink were not solved. If every offender were to receive full advantage of the new program, then the alcoholic, too, must receive the assistance and understanding of all available knowledge and procedures. And in line with this new approach to rehabilitation, I looked upon Alcoholics Anonymous as a tool to help us rebuild lives. A footnote says, Clinton Duffy died in 1982. To Warden Duffy's aid came Warren and other members in the San Francisco area, and thus began the pioneering of AA's first prison group in 1942. As Warden Duffy has since said, had it not been for the regular help and understanding given by our AA friends outside, the San Quentin chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous would most assuredly have failed. And, by the same token, if it had not been for the persistence of that first group of alcoholic inmates who realized their serious problem and their need for help, we could never have continued beyond the first few meetings. But even with such enthusiasm and willingness, there were formidable problems to solve. The establishment of regular AA meetings would mean carloads of AAs from the outside running in and out of prison. It would probably draw the ridicule of other prisoners. Those penologists who still thought hard-boiled methods to be the only way, and those skeptics who thought AA only a useless fad, would shake their heads. It would mean large gatherings of prisoners unattended by guards. The risks were great, but Warden Duffy took them, and his faith was justified. AA soon won the respect of other prisoners, and many of them, although non-alcoholic, wanted to join up anyhow. The morale of what was now a really progressive institution hit a new high. AAs came and went freely. The meetings had only one guard stationed outside the meeting room who was there mainly to care for the needs of the outside AA visitors at the meeting. When the parole figures on alcoholic prisoners suddenly dropped from the usual 80% return to prison to a spectacular 20% and held that way, skeptics were everywhere convinced. This piece of pioneering made AA history. More than 300 prison groups have since been established behind prison walls. We know for sure that thousands of former inmates are today making the grade on the outside. Warren, just mentioned as one of the originators of the first prison group, was also the earliest pioneer of AA in industry. At the time of the prison venture, he was employed at the nearby Kaiser Shipyards to look after the alcohol problem there. Though his success was notable, it was only a starter. A few years later, he and his AA wife, Alice, had persuaded the top management of one of America's leading railroads that something could be done in their offices and out on the lines for afflicted workers. This was perhaps the understatement of the year. Still on the job today, Warren and Alice can count recoveries among their railroad friends by the hundreds. And it is surely no coincidence that this road has meanwhile achieved an unsurpassed safety record. It is certain that other carriers will one day make use of this outstanding model for the rehabilitation of their alcoholic workers. A footnote says Warren died soon after the 1957 publication of this volume. Before returning to the aftermath of the Saturday Evening Post piece, let's journey down the coast to Los Angeles. Just before the big book came out in 1939, we had made a pre-publication mimeograph copy of it. 400 of the books in this form were circulated among all kinds of people so that we could correct errors and get suggestions for improvement. Late in that year, I made a business trip to Cleveland and handed one of these mimeographs to a friend who was an attorney. He happened to be the attorney for a wealthy young Clevelander who then lived on the coast, where he had been drinking himself into one dilemma after another. My lawyer friend sent him the pre-publication copy of the big book, and he gobbled it up. He insisted on going straight to Akron, where he placed himself under the tutelage of Dr. Bob and the benign influence of Wally G., in whose home he lived for a time. His ex-wife, K.M., was not an alcoholic, but she turned up in New York full of enthusiasm about AA for itself. She was inspired with the same spirit which is found in the family groups of today. She took a boat to the West Coast and presently landed at Los Angeles, and the next thing we knew, she had looked up Johnny Howe of the city's probation department. He had plenty of drunks on his hands, both hospital inmates and parolees. Johnny had been laboring hard with his charges, but to little avail. When he was shown the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and was told what Kay had seen at the twin meccas of Akron and New York, he became more hopeful and asked Kay to join forces with him, but with certain reservations. Johnny had been running instruction classes for his alcoholic customers on a strictly psychological basis. Know yourself and be free was the idea. The AA book was a revelation to him, but it was a revelation he did not much like at first. He could not go for that surrender to the higher power business. The spiritual side of AA simply was not for Johnny. Legend has it that he and Kay compromised. Johnny would continue his lectures to inmates as before, but he and Kay would try out certain AA ideas on some of the parolees. The prospects were told that they could try Kay's ideas or Johnny's or both. Of course, this sort of approach was not exactly orthodox AA. Nevertheless, it produced some results. For example, certain well-known residents of Los Angeles and vicinity, because of their drinking, had fallen into the hands of the law, and thence into Johnny's hands. On parole, some of them began to take notice of the new dispensation as offered by Kay and Johnny. Hal S. was the very first. He was later to become the founder of the San Diego group. Others who came in the same way were Marshall B., Barney B., and Dr. Forrest H., the latter to become a marathon 12-stepper around Los Angeles in after years. With this much accomplished, K. Kay and Johnny had made a definite start in Los Angeles, and we want to record our thanks to these two non-alcoholics for all they did for us. Meanwhile, the New York office notified the Coast of the coming of Chuck, an artist, and his wife, Lee, who at that time was the AA member of the family, the first alcoholic to arrive from the East. Lee was a real eager beaver. She and Chuck came to Los Angeles just in time to attend the first of the so-called home meetings. This particular gathering was held at Kay's place on Benicia Avenue on December 19, 1939. It included Kay and Johnny, Lee and Chuck, and a number of prospects. Lee agreed with Kay on stressing the spiritual aspects of the AA program, so a chapter from the AA book was read at this meeting. Johnny gave his lecture and delivered a medical paper on alcoholism. For the next few weeks, meetings of this character were held in one home after another. Kay and Lee were for the higher power, and Johnny was still for psychology only. At about this time, Lee secured some publicity in the Los Angeles papers, which brought in more prospects, and finally led to AA's friendship with Ted Leberthon, a prominent Los Angeles columnist whose subsequent articles did a far-reaching job for us. As was to be expected, this little pioneering group had many difficulties, both personal and doctrinal. Frantic letters from the several contestants poured into our one-room headquarters in New York. Finally, Lee began to drink. She called upon Johnny to hospitalize her and was out in a few days. This was, however, a very heavy jolt to everyone. But the group nonetheless survived for the time being. Lee and Chuck then returned east to live happily, and both of them soberly ever since. While all this was going on, a Denver resident named Mort J. had bought the AA book in September of 1939. Without even looking through the volume, Mort dropped it into his suitcase and set off on a spree that lasted several weeks. He finally came to himself at Palm Springs and discovered the AA book in his luggage. Shaking violently, he began to read. This was sometime in November 1939, and he has never had a drink since. Mort was a book convert, pure and simple. In March 1940, Mort moved to Los Angeles. He looked up the Benicia Group and found that it had just about fallen apart. Erstwhile stalwarts like Hal and Dr. H. were rarely seen. Kay was downright discouraged and said she was going to Honolulu. Just as she left, she gave Mort a small list of prospects that hadn't yet been visited. That first candle at Los Angeles was flickering, but it never quite went out. Mort got busy at once on Kay's list and promptly turned up a customer named Cliff W. This one grabbed for the lifeline, and he soon sobered up for good. At his own expense, Mort hired a meeting place at Los Angeles Cecil Hotel. Right then, another book convert, Frank R., put in his appearance. A real sanitarium commuter, Frank had read the AA book in Arizona and had, at the suggestion of the New York headquarters, rushed to Los Angeles to see if what it said was really true. This founding trio soon enlarged the Cecil meeting. Mort insisted on reading from Chapter 5 of the AA book at the start of every session. This firmly established a custom for which AA on the West Coast is now notable, and it put the Cecil group on a four-square AA basis. The debate whether the meeting was to center around psychology or around God as we understand him was at an end. The first solid foundation for AA in Southern California was thus built. In fact, the Cecil Hotel meeting after a while became known as the Los Angeles Mother Group. From New York, we tried hard to keep Los Angeles in good cheer and advice. The AA book became their mainstay, even their Bible. They were not to see a sober, experienced AA member from outside their area for a long while to come. Once they plaintively wrote us, "Well, we've got a lot of people sober out here, but we do sometimes wonder if anybody is sober east of the Rocky Mountains. We haven't seen a single Easterner who is really dry." They've all been drunk, every one of them. Led by Mort, the three elders continued to push on, and so did their wives. Mort's wife, Frances, backstopped the huge amount of 12-step work that Mort began to do. Frank was at times laid low by a recurring fever, and his wife, Eleanor, would take over his prospects and carry on his large correspondence with the New York office. When, in the following year, the Saturday Evening Post article appeared, Cliff had a telephone installed in his home under the AA name in order to handle the enormous demand for quick help. Cliff's wife, Dorothy, carried this load of work to a point of her complete exhaustion. The efforts of these six will always be well remembered in the annals of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Saturday Evening Post piece not only brought in large numbers of new members, it also added several scores of magnificent workers of all kinds and conditions. Never could Los Angeles have prospered as it did without their labors over the years to follow. It is regrettable that in the limited range of this book, we cannot detail all their wonderful services. Now, let us return once more to the aftermath of the Saturday Evening Post article. Lois and I visited Los Angeles sometime in 1943, and the groups called a meeting in the American Legion Hall. When I peered out from behind the curtain, I saw 1,000 people sitting there. It was incredible. Here was evidence that AA could cross the seas and mountains pretty much on its own. In the future, no alcoholic messenger in the flesh might be needed at all. The rush and resulting growing pains in Los Angeles had been appalling. It seemed impossible that they could have stood the confusion and the pace. Before this first visit was over, I began to wonder if they could continue to bear up under it. Yet, in 1950, only 7 years later, I spoke to an AA audience in the Shrine Auditorium where 7,000 members and their families were gathered. By then, Los Angeles County represented the most densely populated AA region in our whole fellowship. Today, it harbors 14,000 members, and they are as solid as Gibraltar. On that first 1943 trip to the coast, Lois and I also looked in on Doc H., an Oregon chiropractor who was struggling with the alkies in Portland. And in Seattle, Washington, we first met businessman Dale A., who with real valor was trying hard to hold a small band together there. This he was able to do, and they went on to real success. Meanwhile, Minneapolis got underway. Chicago's Chan F. and Bill Y. were pinned down there by a 1940 blizzard, and they took time out to carry the message to an alcoholic named Pat C. Pat took on the hectic job of trying to start an AA group and a club at the same time. He persuaded one of the city's flower barons to sell the AAs his former townhouse on a shoestring. Today, there is no more club-minded group in all of AA than this one. The AA life of the town still gathers around that pioneering monument. And believe it or not, those Minneapolis alkies burned the mortgage on that clubhouse in just 3 years' time. As I remember it, Buffalo and Pittsburgh started up not much later. And right out in the middle of the country, that most loved salesman, Johnny P., had put in an appearance to plant AA in Kansas City, Missouri. This touched off another group right across the river in Kansas City, Kansas. It was sparked by one of AA's first doctor members, Miles N., who was later to become a prodigious AA worker and a national authority on the chemistry of drunks. In these same years, the Boston Irish had joined forces with certain Back Bayers and had grabbed the AA lifeline with a will, forming that wonderful nucleus from which so much of AA in New England later stemmed. The Boston group provided us with a fresh wonder and a big heartbreak, too. Its founder could never get sober himself, and he finally died of alcoholism. Patty was just too sick to make it. Slip followed slip, but he came back each time to carry AA's message, at which he was amazingly successful. Time after time, the group nursed him back to life. Then came the last bender, and that was it. This very sick man left behind him a great group and a AAA rating for Valor. His first two successes, Bert C. and Jenny B., carry on to this day. Such was our adolescence. I hope that someday many more of its wonderful stories can be told. This was the welter of exciting and fearsome experience out of which AA's 12 traditions were drawn and first put to paper in 1946. Against this background, we shall now consider those 12 traditions, the vital principles upon which the survival of Alcoholics Anonymous so heavily depends. Implicit throughout AA's traditions is the confession that our fellowship has its sins. We confess that we have character defects as a society, and that these defects threaten us continually. Our traditions are a guide to better ways of working and living, and they are also an antidote for our various maladies. The 12 traditions are to group survival and harmony what AA's 12 steps are to each member's sobriety and peace of mind. But the 12 traditions also point straight at many of our individual defects. By implication, they ask each of us to lay aside pride and resentment. They ask for personal as well as group sacrifice. They ask us never to use the AA name in any quest for personal power or distinction or money. The traditions guarantee the equality of all members and the independence of all groups. They show how we may best relate ourselves to each other and to the world outside. They indicate how we can best function in harmony as a great whole. For the sake of the welfare of our entire society, the traditions ask that every individual and every group and every area in AA shall lay aside all desires, ambitions, and untoward actions that could bring serious division among us or lose for us the confidence of the world at large. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous symbolize the sacrificial character of our life together, and they are the greatest force for unity that we know. A footnote advises CAA's 12 traditions. Take tradition 1. It says that our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Probably no society sets a higher value on the personal welfare of the individual member than does AA. But long ago, we found that the common welfare had to come first. Without it, there could be mighty little personal welfare. In the beginning, we felt very much like Eddie Rickenbacker and his company when their plane crashed in the Pacific. They had been saved from death, but found themselves still floating upon a dangerous sea. There was no doubt in their minds that the common welfare came first. Nobody dared rock that raft, lest they all perish. Bread and water were shared equally. There were no gluttons. Our case was something like that. But some of our sick and careless members did rock the raft, and that scared us to death. Some of those early fears are today almost amusing. The first big one was that of slips or relapses. At first, nearly every alcoholic we approached began to slip, if indeed he sobered up at all. Others would stay dry 6 months or maybe a year and then take a skid. This was always a genuine catastrophe. We would all look at each other and say, "Who next?" We were afraid that alcohol might completely undo us. But today we see tens of thousands of members completely sober for 5, 10, 15, or even 20 years. Slips are a very serious difficulty, but as a group, we take them in stride. Fear has evaporated. Alcohol always threatens the individual, but we know that it cannot destroy the common welfare. The next big scare was the out-of-bounds romance, the well-known triangle. In the cases of more than half of our membership, the family relation had been distorted. Drinking had turned the husband into the household's bad boy, and the wife into his protective and possessive mother. When this relation persisted after AA, The husband sometimes got the wandering eye. Alcoholic women, whose husbands had long since cast them off, put in an appearance. Here and there, we began to witness explosions gathering around these situations. People violently took sides. Whole groups got into uproars, and a number of people got drunk. There was some throwing of rocks at the sinners. We trembled for AA's reputation and for its survival. But at last we woke up to the fact that we were not having any more sex difficulties than other societies, and possibly less. We found that these situations would often right themselves if they were treated with patience and kindness. The sinners and the self-righteous eventually saw the folly of their ways. Most alcoholics, whose wives had seen them through their terrible days, returned to the straight and narrow. The Al-Anon family groups put in an appearance and did wonders for AA's domestic relations. So these experiences all conspired toward a good end. AA's present divorce rate is among the lowest in the whole world. It became apparent that the relationship between the sexes was not going to do us in after all, and our fears in this area subsided. But, like other societies, we soon found that there were forces among us that could threaten us in ways that alcohol and sex could not. These were the desires for power, for domination, for glory, and for money. They were all the more dangerous because they were invariably powered by self-righteousness, self-justification, and the destructive power of anger, usually masquerading as righteous indignation. Pride and fear and anger, these are the prime enemies of our common welfare. True brotherhood, harmony, and love, fortified by clear insights and right practices, are the only answers. And the purpose of AA's traditional principles is to bring these forces to the top and keep them there. Only then can our common welfare be served. Only then can AA's unity become permanent. Now let us think about tradition 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. We AAs have learned this principle the hard way. Few obstacles have been tougher to remove than those which block the way to realization that AA's group conscience can be the only ultimate authority in our affairs. I expect that many an old-timer still does not believe this proposition. He feels that he is older and more experienced than recent generations of AAs, and that it was his guidance and leadership that brought them into the new life. We oldsters often construed our longer experience as a sort of vested right, even an unlimited license to run AA indefinitely. Whenever we got sick, tired, or old, we naturally thought ourselves entitled to handpick our own successors. Who could know better than we? But with the passage of time, most of us came up against some hard facts of AA life. We ruefully discovered that the groups, no matter how much they liked and respected us, simply did not want us to be the self-appointed managers of their service and policy affairs forever. Neither would they let us pick our own successors to do the job for them. They wanted to name their own service committees. Again and again, they showed us that the ultimate authority must speak through the groups. For some of us, this was tough to take. Harder still to accept was the now proven fact that the conscience of the group, when properly informed of the facts and issues and principles involved, was often wiser than any leader, self-appointed or not. We slowly realized that the old-timer frequently was faulty in judgment. Because of his position of assumed authority, he was too often influenced by personal prejudices and interests. With all his experience and good works, there was still nothing infallible about him at all. Does this mean that as old-timers, our usefulness is over? No. Once we old-timers have surrendered to the group conscience, we are pleasantly surprised to find that the groups, when in deep difficulty, will again turn to us for the kind of guidance that only our longer experience can give. I well remember when I had to swallow my first dose of this hard but healthy doctrine. In 1937, the financial going was rough at 182 Clinton Street. Several Alkies were living with us, most of them paying no board. Lois was still in the department store, and her pay was just about all the money we had. Meanwhile, many of the sober members coming to our weekly meetings were back on their feet and earning good money. One day at Charlie Towns Hospital, Charlie beckoned me into his office for one of his Dutch uncle talks. "Look here, Bill," said he, "I've got a hunch that this AA business of yours is someday going to fill Madison Square Garden. Now, I am not a religious man, and you must know that I was mighty skeptical of this business when it first came in here. Silkworth really scared me by his cooperation with you. But that is all changed. I believe in you people. Your methods are going to work." And he said, "Look, Bill, don't you see you're getting the bad end of this deal? You are starving to death, and your wife is working at that store. All around you, these drunks are getting well and making money. But you're giving this work full time, and still you're broke. It isn't fair." Charlie fished in his desk and came up with an old financial statement. Handing it to me, he continued, "This shows the kind of money this hospital used to make back in the 1930s. Thousands of dollars a month. It should be doing just as well now. And it would, if only you'd help it. So why don't you move your work in here? I'll give you an office, decent drawing account, and a very healthy slice of the profits. What I propose is perfectly ethical. You can become a lay therapist and more successful than anybody in the business." I was bowled over. There were a few twinges of conscience until I saw how really ethical Charlie's proposal was. There was nothing wrong whatever with becoming a lay therapist. I thought of Lois coming home exhausted from the department store each day, only to cook a supper for a house full of drunks who were not paying board. I thought of the large sum of money I still owed my Wall Street creditors. I thought of some of my alcoholic friends who were making as much money as they ever did. Why shouldn't I do as well as they? Although I asked Charlie for a little time to consider it, my own mind was about made up. Going back to Brooklyn on the subway, I had a flash of seeming divine guidance. It was only a single sentence, but it was most convincing. In fact, it came right out of the Bible. A voice kept saying to me, "The laborer is worthy of his hire." At home, I found Lois cooking as usual, while three drunks looked hungrily on from the kitchen door. I drew her aside and told her the glorious news. She looked interested, but not as excited as I thought she should be. It was meeting night. Although few of the alcoholics we boarded seemed to get sober, some others had. With their wives, they crowded into our downstairs parlor. At once, I burst into the story of my opportunity. I never shall forget their impassive faces and the steady gazes they focused on me. With waning enthusiasm, my story trailed off to the end. There was a long silence. Almost timidly, one of my friends began to speak. "We know how hard up you are, Bill," he said. "It bothers us a lot. We've often wondered what we might do about it. But I think I speak for everyone here when I say that what you now propose bothers us an awful lot more." The speaker's voice grew more confident. "Don't you realize," he went on, "that you can never become a professional? As generous as Charlie has been to us, don't you see that we can't tie this thing up with his hospital or any other? You tell us that Charlie's proposal is ethical. Sure, it's ethical. But what we've got won't run on ethics only. It has to be better. Sure, Charlie's idea is good, but it isn't good enough. This is a matter of life and death, Bill, and nothing but the very best will do." My friends looked at me challengingly as their spokesman continued. "Bill, haven't you often said, right here in this meeting, that sometimes the good is the enemy of the best?" Well, this is a plain case of it. You can't do this thing to us. Thus spoke the group conscience. The group was right, and I was wrong. The voice on the subway was not the voice of God. Here was the true voice welling up out of my friends. I listened, and, thank God, I obeyed. Three blows, well and truly struck, had fallen on the anvil of group experience. They rang in my consciousness. The common welfare must come first. AA cannot have a class of professional therapists. And God, speaking in the group conscience, is to be our final authority. Clearly implied in these three embryo principles of tradition was a fourth. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Tradition three, for a long time, was a puzzler, too. The only requirement for AA membership is a sincere desire to stop drinking. We worried a lot about membership. In fact, when heavy publicity first came our way, we were scared witless. We said to ourselves, won't all kinds of odd people show up? Complications, you know, alcohol mixed with other things. In those days, we were always talking about the mythical character called the pure alcoholic. No complications, you understand, just a guzzler. We actually thought we were like that ourselves. Hence, when members began pouring in, our worry mounted. Won't there be mighty queer people? Won't there be criminals? Won't there be social undesirables, we ask? Mixed with a certain amount of snobbishness and smugness, this was downright fear. We simply did not know what or who would turn up. Since that early time, literally all kinds of people have found their way into Alcoholics Anonymous. Our inclusiveness is now very broad indeed. For example, not too long ago I sat talking in my office with a member who bears a title of Countess. That same night, I went to an AA meeting. It was a winter night, and there was a mild-looking little gent taking the coats. He was not charging anything, either. He was just doing it to be obliging. I said, "Who's that little guy?" And somebody answered, "Oh, he's been around for a long time. Everybody likes him. He used to be one of Al Capone's mob." That's how universal AA is today. But it took us a long, long time to become really democratic. There used to be so many membership rules out among the groups that if they were all enforced at once, nobody, actually nobody, could have joined Alcoholics Anonymous. But as our fears subsided, we finally said to ourselves, who are we to keep anybody out? To many a desperate drunk, AA is the court of his last appeal. How can we slam the door on anybody who stands outside? No, we must never do that. We must always take the risk, no matter who comes in. Maybe our public relations will be damaged because a few strange characters are among us. Of course, our public relations are important, but is not the real character of this society still more important? Who of us dares to say, no, you can't come in, thereby setting himself up as a judge, jury, and perhaps executioner of his brother alcoholic? So the experience through the years, now distilled into Tradition 3, says, you are an AA member if you say so. No matter what you have done or still will do, you are an AA member as long as you say so. Now here comes Tradition 4. It declares that each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. As one of the people who helped start this movement, I thought for a long time that I ought to be able to manage it from New York. But I soon found that I could do no such thing. Neither could anybody else at AA's headquarters. The groups said to us, we like what you are doing. Sometimes your suggestions and advice are good. But whether to take you or leave you alone is going to be our decision. Out in the groups, we are going to run our own show. We are not going to have a personal government in New York or anywhere else. Services, yes, but government, no. Hence AA's tradition of group autonomy, It didn't take long to formulate that one. They told us just what they wanted, and that included the right to be wrong. To illustrate, years ago in a certain town, a super promoter got sobered up in AA. At once he got very big ideas, all for the good of AA, of course. As he saw it, the right setup would require a very big building and would take an awful lot of money. On one floor, there would be a club. On the next floor, there would be a meeting room. On the next, a clinic and rehabilitation center. Upstairs, there surely would have to be a loan agency where the indigent alcoholic could borrow a little spare cash. Such was his vision of the new center. He was some promoter, this one, and he actually sold the townspeople on his idea. He, naturally, was to become the general manager. His blueprint involved three separate corporations, one for the club, one for the clinic, and one for the loan department. Altogether, he wrote 61 rules, regulations, and bylaws to make these corporations do their good work. With the exception of a few diehards, his fellow AAs were sold. He was the man of the hour. He applied to New York for a super charter. Hearing of this, some of the dissenters wrote us. We had to tell them that each AA group could manage its own affairs as it liked, provided it did not harm surrounding groups. But as strongly as we dared, we did point out that even less grandiose schemes of a like character had failed everywhere before, as it had a right to. This very autonomous group ignored our warnings. Maybe you can guess what happened. After many a rumbling, the crash came. It was like a boiler explosion in a clapboard factory. The thump of colliding egos could be heard and felt for miles. But, of course, things quieted down, and after a long interval, we heard from the promoter. He wrote, "You told us that outside enterprises can be fine and very helpful, but you also said that they could not be mixed with AA. I figured that they could be, and should be. Well, you folks at headquarters were right, and I was wrong." With his letter, the promoter sent us a card, which he had already mailed to every group in the United States. It was folded, like a golf scorecard, and on the outside was printed, "Group so-and-so, place so-and-so, rule number 62. When the card was unfolded, a single pungent sentence met the eye: "Don't take yourself too damn seriously." Thus, under Tradition 4, an AA group had exercised its right to be wrong. Moreover, it had performed a great service for Alcoholics Anonymous because it had been humbly willing to apply the lessons it had learned. It had picked itself up with a laugh and had gone on to better things. Even the chief architect, standing in the ruins of his dream, could laugh at himself, and that is the acme of humility. Some may think that we have carried the principle of group autonomy to extremes. For example, in its original long form, Tradition 4 declares, "Any two or three gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation." This means that these two or three alcoholics could try for sobriety in any way they liked. They could disagree with any or all of AA's principles and still call themselves an AA group. But this ultra-liberty is not so risky as it looks. In the end, the innovators would have to adopt AA principles, at least some of them, in order to remain sober at all. If, on the other hand, they found something better than AA, or if they were able to improve on our methods, then in all probability we would adopt what they discovered for general use everywhere. This sort of liberty also prevents AA from becoming a frozen set of dogmatic principles that could not be changed even when obviously wrong. Healthy trial and error always have their day and place in AA. Of course, any dissident group is urged, though never commanded, not to make any other affiliation. Obviously, we could not very well have Catholic AA groups, Protestant AA groups, Republican AA groups, Democratic AA groups, or Communist AA groups. Nor should an AA group ally itself with any particular brand of medical or psychiatric treatment. We can cooperate with anyone, but the name Alcoholics Anonymous must be reserved for us only.